Thank you.
My name is Ted Whiting. I'm honored to be here. I'm also very nervous to be here. I don't normally talk about this with a lot of people, just a handful of people. I should give you a little bit of my background, only because a little bit of my background plays into some of my experiences. When I was young, I was Superman, in that every time I got hurt, it either didn't hurt me or I recovered. And I got hurt a lot of times. And why I'm still here, maybe only God knows, because I don't. The experiences I've had with injury and recovery, they can mount up into the hundred. It's quite a list of things I've been through. Another thing that is in my history is my parents. My mom and my original dad were divorced when I was very young. I had only spoke to my real dad possibly four times in my life. So I didn't know him. I didn't know him at all. In fact, the last time that I did speak to him, he was just like Joe Blow walking down the road. He was a stranger. I didn't know him. I did know my stepdad. And my stepdad and my mom, when I was growing up, were alcoholics. So I grew up in a very violent atmosphere. And my way of surviving that was anger. And I had no in between, from calm to very angry. There was no in between. It was instant. So that was how I survived. So that's just a little bit about maybe why I survived the things I've survived. Maybe I did because I'm just hard to get along with. I don't know. At any rate, when I was 24 years old, I had a motorcycle. And being the cool Eddie that I was, I would drive my motorcycle around. The whole summer, I drove my motorcycle with only short pants. I didn't have a helmet. I didn't have shoes. I just had short pants, and I had a good tan. In the wintertime, however, it was a little different story. I was still driving my motorcycle on November 18th, 1978, and I was dressed in about every kind of leather option you could get for motorcycles because it was freezing cold. And there aren't a lot of motorcycles on the road in November. And there was snow on the road. And I'm cruising down the road going to work on my motorcycle, and I was probably going maybe a smidgen too fast, maybe a little bit more than that. And there was a young lady who didn't see me. She pulled out in front of me, and the motorcycle stopped, and I didn't. I flew a great distance down the road, and I knew when I was going to hit the road because I remember saying, this is really going to hurt. I landed on my head. I split my helmet, which I had on, and it split the helmet right down the middle, just cracked it right, perfectly right down the middle. And then I proceeded to roll because my inertia just kept me going. And by the time I got done rolling, I only had a pair of pants and part of my shirt on. Everything else was gone because it had just got ripped off. And I was so angry. I mean, I went from cruising down the road, minding my own business, to being wrecked and smashed and almost naked on the road. I was pretty ticked off. A fellow that happened to see the accident was a kid I went to high school with. And at the time, I didn't remember him. Afterwards, I remembered him. But at the time, he came running down the road to me. He actually thought that I was dead. I got up. And I think he went into shock worse than me. At the time, he was totally surprised that I stood up. And then he thought that I had one of my legs had been torn off because at the impact, my boot had been torn off one of my legs, and he thought that was my leg. And his first question was, how can you stand on one leg? And I looked at him like, you know, get serious, what are you talking about? At any rate, I said, who hit me? And way down the road, there was this girl in this brand new car. It was a 1978 Monte Carlo. Her parents bought her for graduation. And she was just crying. And it didn't matter, I was going to go down there and kill her. Because I was so angry. And then I went into shock. And I went to the hospital and all that stuff, and that hurt me up a little bit. It damaged my body a little bit, and I recovered. My motorcycle wasn't so fortunate. It took a year and 1 month for my motorcycle to come back to me. And it took 1 month after that before I was in another motorcycle accident. The second motorcycle accident, yeah, most people would, you know, one motorcycle accident would be enough to keep you off, but that wasn't the case for me. I'm indestructible, and I'm smart, and I'm smarter than everybody else, and that's what happened. The second motorcycle accident was much worse, but much less dramatic. I was hit broadside. I was smashed into another car and smashed on the road. And that was it. It took a second, and I was on the road, and I had no idea what was going on. Between both motorcycles accidents, it did a lot of damage to me. The second motorcycle accident just compounded the previous injuries. So consequently, I had some pretty severe back injuries. As time went on, and I was in the hospital from that accident for a few days, and I got up, and you know, I recovered, and I'm still Superman. But as time wore on, mortality began to ebb into my existence. And meaning that as I began to walk and use my body, it became quite apparent that there were some things wrong, and my back was the biggest thing that was suffering. Every step that I took was a degree of pain that I didn't like. It was a great deal of pain. And it got to the point where I couldn't walk any longer because the pain was so severe. At that time, I was fortunate enough to find a surgeon who would find out what was wrong with me. Because all the x-rays said, you know, there's nothing wrong, we can't see anything wrong. This surgeon was a neurosurgeon, and he was quite competent and full of himself, and I'm glad he was. Because he said, okay, we're going to figure out what's wrong. We're going to operate on you, and this operation is going to take 2 hours, and you'll be just fine. The operation didn't go that way, and this was in 1981. The operation was scheduled for 2 hours. 5 hours later, I was in the intensive care unit, and I had, you know, they brought me around, and I was conscious, and I asked them for pain medication. They said, you can't have pain medication. And I said, well, I'm in a great deal of pain. At that time, I think the pain was worse than before the operation, because the pain was, I was laying down, and the pain was absolutely excruciating. And he said, no, he said, you can't have pain medication. And in the room with the doctor was the anesthesiologist, one of the OR nurses, and the ICU nurse. And my mother was there. My mother was probably shouldn't have been there. She was crying like I was dying. And I looked at her and I thought, why is she crying so much? And as it turned out that I couldn't have pain medication because my blood pressure was so low, it hardly didn't register. The doctor told me, he says, well, he says, if we give you pain medication, he said, you're going to die. He said, you can't have it. He said, your blood pressure's too low. And I looked at him and I said, well, I said, I've died already. I said, what difference does it make? And when I said that to him, he looked at the anesthesiologist and they looked at each other. And the two nurses looked at each other and they looked at me. They didn't say a word. They didn't argue. They didn't say what happened. They didn't say anything. They just looked at me. And I thought, that's a little odd for these people to hear that and not say anything. I thought, something is going on here. What do they know? I don't know. Well, I knew what they didn't know. I had died. What I'll do is I'll explain this experience to you. I'm on the operating table. Of course, I'm out, and then I'm dead. And it appears to me that I'm being lowered down or just set down on this area, I'm on this sandy knoll, and my dad is in front of me. I didn't see a bright light. I didn't go through a tunnel. It was as if I was set down in front of him. And my dad is standing there, and I thought, this is a little odd. I know my dad's dead, and I knew who he was because I had seen him before. I thought, I know my dad's dead, and if he's dead, where am I? And the first thing he said to me was, Ted, he says, I'm so sorry. He said, I apologize that you're going through this. And I said, well, you're dead. And he said, yes. He said, I'm dead. I thought, oh, this is an odd thing. But I wasn't in any pain. And he said, you're going to have to go back. And I said, no, I'm not going back to that pain. I'm not going to live my life in that pain. The pain's more than I can handle. I'm not going back. And he said, well, okay. He said, you have to go back. He said, but let's take a walk. He said, let's go talk. And I said, okay. as I was walking with him, I kind of looked around to see what I could see. And we appeared to be on a knoll, kind of higher than the valley that was around us. I was walking on a path that was dirt or very fine sand, I'm not sure which. It was very, very fine. It wasn't hard. It didn't hurt my feet. I was barefoot. The area around me was, on either side of this pathway, was grass. It was green. It was just perfectly green. The air was fresh and smelled good, and it was warm. It wasn't hot, and it wasn't cold. There was a slight breeze. If you're on a day where the temperature's kind of hot, and you feel a breeze blow across you, and it feels really good, that's what this breeze was like, and it would come across me every once in a while. So it wasn't that I was hot, it's just that there was a refreshing breeze that would blow over me. My dad and I continued to walk. We walked along this path. We came to this bench, and I thought that was a little odd, but we came to a bench, and the bench was made out of sandstone. It looked familiar because I'd seen sandstone benches like this before. It was probably 3 or 4 feet long. It was easily 8 inches thick, and the sides of it that held it up, they were probably 8 or 10 inches thick themselves, and it was a very comfortable sandstone bench. We sat down, and we started talking. I knew that my dad had died a pretty awful death. My dad was drowned. He was actually murdered. And I asked him, I said, you drowned, didn't you? And he said, yes. And I said, is that painful? And he said, the most painful thing about it was the first breath of water. He said, that's painful. He said, after that, he said, it wasn't painful. He said, if you have to choose a way to die, he said, that's not so bad. He said, there's other ways that are worse to die than drowning. So he told me a little bit about that. And then he again apologized to me. And he said, I'm so sorry that I wasn't there for you. He said, I'm not trying to make excuses. He said, I'm just telling you that I apologize for not being there as a father. He said, I apologize to you for not being there to help bring you and raise you. And I just kind of accepted that, like, you know, okay, whatever. And he said, but you have to go back. And I said, I really don't want to go back. I said, I think I can stay here. He says, no. He says, you have to go back. He said, there's things you have to do. He said, there's people you have to see. And he said, you have to raise your 2 sons. And I said, I don't have any kids. I'm not even married. I don't have a girlfriend. I said, so there's no kids, there's no girlfriend, there's no prospects. I don't have anything to worry about. I can stay here. And he said, no. He said, you have to go back. He says, you're going to have 2 sons. He says, I have met your sons. And he said, you have great kids. And I thought, no, this can't be happening. He's met my sons. And then we got up, and he started walking me back to where I had appeared to him. And he said, it's time for you to go back now. He said, you really have to go back. And I said, no, I don't want to go back. And he put his hands on my chest, and he pushed me. And I thought, yeah, okay, this is typical, you know. When you're pushing me away, you know, I just get here, and you're pushing me away. You know, this kind of stuff was going through my head. At any rate, he pushed me away, and I just kind of disappeared. The distance between us became greater and greater and greater, and he was gone. And then I woke up in the ICU, where my mother was crying like I was dying, and the doctors wouldn't give me pain medication. I was pretty ticked off. So I did recover from that operation. I guess my immortality hadn't left me altogether. It did take me 3 months, but I did fully recover from that operation, and I felt good. But I didn't get on a motorcycle again. I learned my lesson. Between that experience, that was 1981, and 1991, I had always been a mechanic in my life. I've always been interested in mechanics, and I'm just a natural-born mechanic. I can take things apart. I can put them back together. I know how to do it, and there's not a mystery to me. For some people, it's a mystery, and I can't figure that out. It is, but for me, it wasn't. So I became a diesel mechanic, and I was a good diesel mechanic. I mean, I was faster than anybody else. The work was hard. It was challenging. It was heavy. And when I got home from work, I didn't want to work on anything else. I had cars and cars and cars and cars. But when I became a diesel mechanic, the cars disappeared because I did not want to work on cars again. I just got tired of it. It burned me out. Being a diesel mechanic was too heavy. At any rate, I was really good at it. So I'm working on a truck. And this is 1989, actually. I'm working on a truck, and the air horn on the truck is not working. Well, air horns are a snap to fix. I mean, there can only be two things wrong with them. Either the switch doesn't work or the airline's got a hole in it. And that's it. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I can fix this. It's no problem. So up on the cab I go. You got to get on the ladder. You climb up on the cab of the truck. You fix, find out what's wrong. You fix it, you know, and you get back down. You try it. And that's what I did. I went through the whole process. I fixed the air horn. I got off the truck. Started up, build up the air, honked the horn, it worked great, of course it would, because I fixed it. Well, that's what I thought, you know, I'm so confident in myself. That's part of being immortality, that's part of your immortality, you know, it's part of being Superman, because you're so confident in yourself. At any rate, I thought, I turned the truck off and got out of the cab, and it's a cab over truck, so it's a pretty tall truck. And I thought, where's my tools? And I'm looking around, I can't find my tools. And I thought, how stupid. I left my tools up on top of the truck. And so I got up on the ladder, and I got my tools, and I stood up, and that's the last thing I remember. A friend of mine that had come to work, I was working the night shift, he was working the graveyard shift, he came in, and he kicked me. And I'm laying on the floor, and he kicked me, and he says, what are you doing on the floor? And I couldn't answer him. I had no idea what I was doing on the floor. And what had happened was I had picked my tools up, stood up on the truck, and fell off. I stepped back, like being not very egocentric, I stepped back and thinking that, you know, whatever, I don't know, whatever. Anyway, things like this don't happen to Superman, but anyway, they did. I stepped back off of this truck, and this truck is 12 and a half feet high. The top of this cab is 12 and a half feet off the ground, and I stand 6 feet. So my head is 18 feet off the ground, and when I step back, I fell back on my head and my back and my shoulder, and it knocked me out. I was actually very fortunate to live. Most people that have accidents like this where they've hit their head, they fall much less distances, and they die. And I lived. And why I lived, I don't know. It's because all of the other accidents that I've had and all the other things that I've been through, I've survived it. And I survived this as well. Well, it created a lot of problems. I mean, there were some severe injuries from that accident. I injured my shoulder. I suffered a severe head injury. It was pretty severe. It took about 15 years to overcome most of the real apparent side effects of the injury. And it took a lot out of me. I've been operated on 30-something times probably because of that accident. But I survived. However, in 1991, because I could no longer be a diesel mechanic, one of the side effects was I could not maintain my concentration. That's one of the side effects of a head injury. There are several side effects of head injuries that I learned later. At any rate, I couldn't work on trucks anymore. I went from being the night supervisor to the brand new employee because I couldn't remember a thing. I couldn't remember the most basic, rudimentary things for working on a diesel truck. I couldn't time it. I couldn't change the valves. I couldn't do this. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do any of it. I had to ask the people I was working with, how do I do this? And they looked at me really funny. As time wore on, it became quite apparent I could no longer do that job. So I quit. I wound up going to school. I was in Salt Lake Community College. One day, while I was there, I developed a headache. And the headache got pretty bad. It got pretty severe. And it got worse, and it got worse over about a 3-day, 4-day, 5-day period. The headache got worse, and it got to the point where I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand this headache. And I called my younger brother up, who came to pick me up in the car that I had built for him, the little bugger. I had built him this race car, and that's another story anyway. He came and picked me up in this car. It was the first ride I had in this car with him, actually. And he took me home, and by the time I had got home, I couldn't stay home. I said, you've got to take me to the hospital. I said, I can't stand this. I said, there's something wrong. I can't stand. The pain in my head is too severe. I mean, the pain in my head was so severe I was vomiting because the pain was just excruciating. It was as bad or worse than my back pain from my operation in 1981. So he took me to the hospital. I couldn't walk when I got to the hospital. I couldn't hardly tell them what was going on. I didn't want people to touch me. The pain was so severe, I didn't want anybody to touch my hair. I couldn't stand the light from the day, just from the daylight, I couldn't stand the light. And they wheeled me into the hospital on a gurney, and I couldn't stand the lights in the hospital. They were too bright for me. And they wheeled me into this room, and my younger brother was telling the doctor something, and at that point I died. And I don't know if I died of pain. I don't know if I died from the severe injury that I had. I don't know. What actually had happened? When I fell off of the truck and hit my head a couple of years earlier, it messed up my sinuses. Now, your sinuses in your head kind of act as a escape for sinus fluids. They kind of act as an air conditioning for the inner part of your head. In your sinus cavities, you have little valves, much as the same as your blood vessels, that go one way. So if you have a sinus infection and your head needs to drain, the fluid goes out, the valve stops, and it won't let it back. So it drains down your nose, down your throat, whatever. When I fell on my head, it had messed up my sinuses to the point where they didn't work. So I got a sinus infection, and I didn't know it. I'd had the sinus infection for a couple of weeks, and then I started getting the headache because it developed, the sinus pressure was building up. Now, a lot of people think that when you have your skull right here, the part that you can touch, that's it. On the other side of this is your brain, but that's not right. You have an inner skull as well. And there's not a lot of distance between them, but there you have an inner and an outer skull. And the sinus pressure was building up in my head, and it was cracking my inner skull to the point to where it was putting pressure on my brain, and that was causing the pain. So I was dying from a sinus infection, of all things. And I died. This time when I died, it was quite a bit different than the first time. Cal, I don't know how to explain this. When I died, I was coming up through water to this beach. I wasn't swimming, but I seemed to be propelled up through the water to this beach. And I came walking out of the water. And I remember when I came walking out of the water, I looked back and I thought, that's really weird. And I looked back across the water, and it wasn't like a lake. It wasn't a pond, but it was a good body of water. But it was perfect, the perfect temperature. If you wanted to be in water, and you know, you want to go water skiing or whatever, it wasn't cold, it wasn't too hot, it was just comfortable, and it was great. And I didn't hurt. But I came out of the water onto this beach, and there is a crowd of people there, more than what's here now. There must have been 200 people there, and they were all there to see me. And I knew everybody there. I could recognize everybody. But in front of the crowd, well, I had three aunts, and in front of the crowd, there were my three aunts, and the one that was the most vocal in life, as in this experience, was my Aunt Maud. She was crazy. And I come up out of the water, and I'm maybe 20 feet away from the water's edge, and she called me Tedder. There were only two people in the world that ever called me Tedder. One of them was my older brother, and one of them was my Aunt Maud. And she said, Tedder, you can't be here, you have to go back. And I thought, you know, what are you mad at me about? You know, I said, no. I said, I'm not going back, Aunt Maud. I'm not going back. I said, the pain's terrific. And I said, no way. I said, I'm not going back. You can't make me go back, and I'm not going back. And she said, Tedder, she said, you are too going back, and you're going back right now. And I said, no, Aunt Maud, I'm not. And I had a conversation with her, and she said, there are people that are relying on you. There are things you have to do. There are things that people you have to meet, and you have to go back and take care of this. This is not your time. You have to go back. And I said, Aunt Maud, I said, I don't care. I don't care about any of those people. I'm staying here. I said, the pain's too terrific. I said, why would I go back to that pain? I'd have to be crazy. And my Aunt Maud put her hands on my chest, and she pushed me back into the water. And I thought, you're not that mean. Why are you doing this to me? But between the time that she pushed me back in the water and the time that we were having our conversation, I kind of looked around. And this time I wasn't on top of a knoll. I was down in kind of a small area, in the bottom of a little valley. And again, The sun was out, but I couldn't see the sun. The temperature was perfect. The water was perfect. There was a breeze. And there was vegetation around. It looked just like the perfect setting of anywhere you would want to be. And she pushed me back in the water. And I flowed back into the water, and my other aunts were standing up on the beach, and as I went back into the water, they just slowly became non-visible, and then I woke up in the hospital, and they had the paddles on my chest, and they were pounding those things on my chest, and this guy was going to hit me again, and that hurts. When those things are on your chest and they give you that jolt, man, that hurts a lot. It's not like you see in the movies, those guys wake up and everything's cool. It's not like that, man. This guy was going to hit me again. I put my arm up. I said, no, man. I said, stop. So because of that injury, I had an emergency sinus operation that lasted a lot longer than it was supposed to. They drilled a hole in my head. The sinus pressure was so great, when they drilled that hole in my head, it was like a squirt gun. This stuff come out all over me, all over the surgeon, all over the entire op. When I woke up from that mess, they had me covered in betadine. That's the stuff they cover you when you're going to operate on you and make an incision. My whole body was red. I thought I'd bled to death right there when I woke up. But that was my experience. I got injured in 1989, and I got operated on 1991. And some of the injuries stay with me from that. But I did survive. And I'm no longer superhuman. I come to my senses and I'm mortal. I did learn a few things from that experience. I learned that the time that we have here is actually pretty short. But where the other side is like eternity. And the only way I can compare that or make that visible for people is for somebody to make a little dot on the wall, a little tiny dot, and then walk away from that dot. You can't see it. And that little dot represents where you are, and the further away you get from that is eternity. And the people that the impression I got when I was there, and I kind of wondered about this, and I thought, why do you all know that I'm here? And my Aunt Maud said, well, we knew you were coming. That's why we're all here. And just my Aunt Maud, I could just slap her. At any rate, the other people didn't talk to me, but I got the impression that they were all happy to see me. I'm pretty glad about that. And they all knew that I was going to be there. And I thought that's a little odd that all those people would know that I was going to be there that particular time. And that's my experience.
What years were your sons born?
My first son was born in 1985. My second son was born in 1986. They're about 14 months apart. And they're very nice kids.
Did you ever feel that, or have a knowledge that there was a higher source there in those experiences? Some may call it a god, some may, you know. Was there ever that sensation?
I can't say that there was a sensation of God. I sensed that I was in a place that was better than where I am now. Who built that, I don't know. But it seemed that there was a sense of this unending love and acceptance. But I can't say that I sensed God. I can't say that.
You had this conversation with your father, and he said that he knew the sons that you were going to eventually have. Can you elaborate on that conversation anymore? Did he talk about them at any length?
He didn't. Okay. Yeah, all he said was, I know you're going to have two boys. I've spoke to them. They're great kids. And you have to go back and take care of them. And I thought it was kind of cheap that maybe he wouldn't, you know, elaborate. You know, what are their names? You know, how big are they? It turns out that both my kids are bigger than me. One's blonde-haired. One's dark-haired. My youngest son is a bear. He's just absolutely huge and very strong. And my oldest son, when he turned 16, he developed this sense of knowledge that he knew everything, and he still has it.
Did you ever question at all in the following years of your life whether that could, and either of those could have been a dream, or how did you feel about that as time went on?
You know, I never once have questioned whether that could be a dream, because I have dreams, and I've had dreams since I was about 2 years old, and I remember most of my dreams, and this is diametrically different than a dream, absolutely different than a dream. And this is as real as what we are having right now. I remember those two instances, even from 1981, 1991 until right now. I mean, I remember those just as if they happened yesterday.
I would like to know if you've ever told your sons about your two near-death experiences.
I've mentioned it a little bit to my sons, and they look at me with this type of blank stare in their head like, are you crazy? And so with my two sons, I don't say a lot about it because they think their dad's crazy if he says something like that, so I don't push it with them.
So I was curious regarding you not having a religious context, spiritual experience with a greater force. Did you have any religion when you were growing up?
Up until the time I was 19, I was agnostic, atheist, anything but LDS. I had an experience with some friends of mine at a campfire. This is a whole other story, but I did convert to being LDS. But my experience with my near-death experiences, there was no religious factor that I could see. However, a lot of the people that were with me the second time that I died were very LDS. But that didn't seem to be a factor. It wasn't like I've got to go back and serve the sacrament, or I've got to go back and teach elders' quorum or anything. Nothing like that came into it.
So you also had the anger, especially at the first motorcycle accident, which was 1978. Did that go away as a result? I guess the question I'm asking is, what did you learn from those two experiences that changed your life that you brought back? That someone, and you know, did anyone say you are a different person?
No, I wasn't a different person, other than I'd had these experiences. I didn't really start to become calm until after I'd married my second wife, who, by the way, is right next to you. She taught me quite a bit about being calm. It was quite a transition. I mean, it took a long time for me to learn the steps of anger and learn the steps of being calm. These near-death experiences, they didn't teach me any of that. I learned other things from them, but I didn't learn that.
Could you elaborate on what those things were?
Well, one of the things I learned from the near-death experiences is there's absolutely no reason to be afraid to die. There is no reason. There's a lot of people that are afraid to die. And I learned, you know, because I've been there. Consequently, because of that, one of the things that this attitude really pisses a lot of people off, especially at funerals, when everybody's crying and having a fit that somebody has died, I feel bad for them because you're going to miss these people. But these people, they've died. They're going to miss you for about 10 seconds because that's all the time compared from eternity until now. That's all the time they're going to have until they turn around. They know you're going to be there. Because eternity is a long time. Here is a short time. We don't need to worry about dying. And so I view death differently. I know that I'm going to see my friends. I'm going to see my loved ones. I know I'm going to see these people because I've been there twice. And I feel bad for other people that don't know this. And there's nothing I can do to convey to them. And at a funeral, you can't say, well, you know, they're just still here, and you're going to see them in about 10 seconds. You can't say that, because they just would slap you, and they would think you're insensitive, and I would be insensitive, so I don't do that. So I've at least learned how to be sensitive about stuff like that.
Did these experiences heighten your awareness in any way or give you any purpose to your life after that?
They both gave me a great deal of curiosity. The first one, when I came back, I thought I'm going to have two sons. And I'm looking around, you know, there's nobody here that's going to be my wife. You know, I'm not going to have... And it's interesting, when I married my first wife, I told her we were going to have two kids. I said, we're going to have two sons. And she said, no, we're not, because I don't want kids. And they were both surprises. And we had two boys. There were other things I learned, but I probably can't talk about some of the things I learned. They're too close to me. I can't talk about some of them.
I was just curious how your original father died. It seems so ironic that that almost Aunt Maud shoved you through the water on the way, symbolically, of how your father died.
I was pretty pissed. I was pretty upset. They both pushed me. You know, that's not fair. My first dad was actually murdered. My first dad was actually quite afraid of water. He liked to fish. He loved to fish. That was his whole life, was fishing. But he would never get in water. He would fish from a bank on a small river, or he would throw his line into a lake, but he would never get on a boat. He was deathly afraid of boats. But when he died, they found him and his friend and both of their dogs wrapped up in fish netting, and they had drowned. And that was one of the things that he told me, that he had been murdered.
So what's your pain level at today?
Between 1991 and now, I, for some reason, haven't stopped having accidents. And I've had several accidents between then and now. My pain level as I stand before you right now is probably a 6 or 7.
With your experience, did it sort of, did it increase your sense of immortality because you knew? I mean, it seems like every time you died and came back, they just said, it's not your time. So did that increase your sense of, I'm not going to go until it's my time anyway? Is every day just gravy, or does it make it more purposeful for you?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. No, it didn't increase my sense of mortality. It probably made me more aware of life and death, and how that they are separate, and how life is, for me, it told me that life is never really over. You make a transition. I explained this one time to somebody. It's like you get on an airplane and you go to visit relatives, and that's how you're dying. You go to visit relatives. And, you know, the ones you leave behind, you leave them behind, and you're visiting new people. It didn't give me a sense of immortality. I think, if I look back on it, I have to really think about that, I think it helped to take my sense of immortality away.
Did you come away with any gifts or any extrasensory-type powers? And then also, have you been able to go back or have any type of an opening back?
The answer to the second question, no. I have no reoccurrence or no door back to that. I've had no dreams of those instances, no other conversations with anything. And in answer to your first question, I won't answer your first question.
Thank you for sharing your story. One of the interesting sidebars, I guess, about near-death experiences that I find is the sensory input people have when they're in these realms. Many talk about seeing things and hearing things, but they're in some kind of ethereal state where they don't physically feel things and smell things. But you were talking about the breeze and the smell of these places, the sand under your feet, and I just found that fascinating. Can you talk about that a little more?
I would find it really difficult for people not to know these things when they die, but every experience is different. We all experience it differently because we are individuals. We have our own way of experiencing things, even in life. You know, two people can look at the same picture and see different things. However, yeah, I felt the sand or the dirt, and I was barefoot the first time with my dad. I was barefoot. I think I was barefoot the second time with my aunt as well, because I felt little pebbles under my feet. And it seemed quite normal to me. actually, that it should be warm and there should be a soft breeze and that I could see the vegetation. The only thing that I wondered about at the time with both experiences is it was very bright. It was a very bright, sunny day, but I could not see the sun.
The people that you saw, your dad and your aunts, were they the age that you had seen them the last time you saw them? Or were they younger? Were they... Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I understand. My dad appeared to be less gnarled. He was kind of gnarled. He was like 55 or somewhere around there when he died, but he led a hard life. He didn't look so beat up. My Aunt Maud, for me, she was always the same age, and I never noticed when she aged. I knew her for a long time. I actually knew her longer than I knew my dad, meaning that I had experienced things with her and interacted with her longer than I had my dad. And it was actually his aunt. My Aunt Maud was my great aunt. It was his mother's sister. Aunt Maud was my father's aunt. She had a way of talking about my dad. It's not, I can't say it because there's no diplomatic way of saying it, but she called him a few things. Yeah, he disappeared in my life. But my Aunt Maud was always the same. She, when I met her, she was, geez, I was 24 when I met her. She had to be in her 50s. And when I saw her, she was still in her 50s.
Did you get any understanding of why your father disappeared from your life?
I kind of knew that before my dad split. My dad wasn't a real nice person. My stepdad wasn't a real nice person, but they're different non-nice people.
Yeah, but that is in this life, that is with this body, that is with these challenges. But the bigger purpose of it all, in the greater scene of it all, what was the reason for him to be your father and for him to have disappeared? There's a bigger picture there.
There may be. And in my experience, it seemed like I was with him for probably a half an hour, 45 minutes, it seemed. However, that didn't become part of our conversation. It wasn't part of our, at least not my mental question at the time. It seemed very natural to have him there. I was surprised that he was there. But after the initial surprise, and he apologized to me, and he told me about his death, and then he told me that I was had to go back, and I was going to have sons, all that just seemed normal. Why he was the one that was there, I don't know. Maybe he wanted to be there. I don't know. You know, that's on his side. That's on the other side of things. And maybe he had a great need to tell me. And he seemed like that he was very sincere about telling me that, you know, he apologized. So I don't know about that.
Were you speaking as we're speaking, or was it telepathically?
No, I was speaking as we're speaking now. Just like we're talking now, with my mouth, with our, yeah, just like we're having a conversation. When I came to see my aunt, I could hear the water behind me. I could hear the little ripples in the water behind me.
Can you describe how people were dressed?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I don't talk to a lot of people about this. As I said before, I don't, because a lot of people think you're crazy. And I'm not crazy. At any rate, they were dressed normal. They were dressed just like, it wasn't special garb or anything. They appeared to be normal. I don't remember what I had on. It seemed that I was dressed normal. I just don't, thinking about it right now, I can't remember what I had on. But that question a lot of people ask me when I tell my experiences. One of the first things they say was everybody naked?
Did you experience family members from both sides of the family or just one?
Just one, I guess. I guess that would be just one.
But to answer another question, because I've been watching my husband for 25 years almost. It has been a privilege to be his wife. He's a great spirit. And I believe those... experiences he had have to do with that. I know that he still somehow was Superman. Because in some funeral, one of my friends at work passed away suddenly, and she was in the, like 30 years old with 6 months baby, and suddenly passed away, and I invited him with me. And he said, I saw a girl coming this way, and described her. And she has never seen my friend, my dear friend. And she said to me, everything will be fine. I know my children will be taken care of. And I thought, but tell me again how she is. Oh, she has long hair, dark hair, beautiful smile. She's very tall, slender. He has never seen my friend. And I had worked with her several years before. So I was still in shock to know that my husband saw her in her funeral in a daylight. So a few things like that, I am still impressed with my husband. Another occasion is he can feel people's the way they are, and I can't. And so one day he said, look in the back of a woman, says, she is so mean. I don't know why she's here. And I fought with him for that from day one when he said that to me in private. And he said, you don't know her name. How can you talk to about her this way? I know this is a bad spirit in our house. And I fought for months and said, you can't say that about somebody that you don't know. And for my dismay, he was completely right. And that proved, after a few years of knowing that person, and I felt bad. But those are the things that my husband has that is not normal for a normal human being to feel or to say. I mean, it's not bad. I feel that is a great gift he has. And we've been channeling together. And I believe that he changed his life, my life, and my children's lives, our children's lives, for good. We have wonderful kids together.